Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
It's never as loud as I'd like it to be. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. You can find InForum online at inforumsf.org. I'm Adam Leshinsky, that's at Adam Leshinsky on Twitter, Senior Editor-at-Large for Fortune and your moderator for the evening. Tonight, we're here for InForum's event, Tom Perkins, The War on the 1%. Tom Perkins, seated next to me, is co-founder of venture capital firm Kleiner, Perkins, Caulfield, and Byers. An alumnus of Harvard and MIT, he is a renowned businessman and, as everyone in this room knows, an outspoken capitalist. In January of this year, shortly after his 82nd birthday, is that correct, Tom?
Yeah.
He wrote a controversial letter to the editor, which was published in the Wall Street Journal. The letter has since gained notoriety for the parallels it makes between Jews in Nazi Germany and the current 1%. Here in the Bay Area, Tom's comments on income inequality feel particularly relevant given the current tensions brewing among San Franciscans and what is known as the techie community. Without any further introduction, please join me in welcoming Tom Perkins. Tom, I want to start at the very top, which is to ask you what the catalyst was for your writing this short letter to the Wall Street Journal.
Well, I think frustrations had been building up for a long time about what I see as the demonization of the rich, but it was a particularly nasty attack on my ex-wife, which triggered my response. So I thought being a Norwegian knight, I should ride to her defense, and I spilled a little more blood than I planned, but I'm not sorry I did it.
I should point out that your ex-wife, Danielle Steele, is in the front row of the auditorium this evening. She came to hear you speak. But you refer to an attack on her. Explain. Where was this attack? Whose attack was it?
Well,
what was the attack?
I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. But
nor do I.
Over the years, the San Francisco Chronicle has had a series of attacks on her. And I won't go into all of them, but there have been a lot of them. And among one of the attacks is she's number one bestseller usually on every book. New York Times, number one. Obviously, her books are being read in San Francisco, but they're never reported in the Chronicle, ever. So anyway, that's what started it all.
And so you decided to write a letter. You were angry about an attack in the San Francisco Chronicle, so you wanted to write about income inequality. Tell everybody briefly what you said in the letter and what your goal was.
Well, it turned out to be the most widely read letter in the history of the Wall Street Journal, which, of course, is surprising. And it's because I used a forbidden word. I used the word Kristallnacht, which it shouldn't be used ever, I suppose. You shouldn't compare anything to the Holocaust, for example, because it's incomparable. And the same with Kristallnacht. Anyway, I said, is there a progressive war on the 1% that could be like the Kristallnacht? And that got everybody's attention. And I made the point that in Germany, 1% of the population was Jewish, and a mad, fiendish dictator used incredible political skills to focus hatred on that 1% and use it as a stepping stone to power. And I saw a parallel between our 1% here in America and that 1%. And so that's the parallel I drew.
Now, you've subsequently apologized for having used a Nazi reference, and you quickly follow that up by saying you are not apologizing for suggesting that victimizing a small minority is a bad idea, period, and that was your point, correct?
That was my point. And I just would like to just talk about this word for a minute. The Wall Street Journal on February 4th ran a rather long op-ed piece, which I've extracted to be very short. And it's by a professor at Harvard, Ruth Weiss. She's a professor of Yiddish and comparative languages, and she's written a couple of books about the Nazis and the Holocaust. And the headline is "The Dark Side of the War on the 1%. Two phenomena, anti-Semitism and the American class conflict. Is there any connection between them? In a letter to the Wall Street Journal, the noted venture capitalist Tom Perkins called attention to certain parallels, as he saw them, between Nazi Germany, its Jews, and American progressives on the 1%. For comparing two such historically disparate societies, Mr. Perkins was promptly and heatedly denounced. But there is something to be said for his comparison of the politics at work in the two situations. And this is, quote, "Are you unemployed? The Jews have your jobs. Is your family mired in poverty? The Rothschilds have your money." The parallel that Tom Perkins drew in his letter was especially irksome to his respondents on the left, many of whom are supporters of President Obama's sallies against Wall Street and the 1%. The ranks of those harping on unfairly high earners are playing with fire. Anyone seeking to understand the inner workings of such a campaign will find much food for thought in Mr. Perkins's parallel.
So I think our overall goal for the evening is to explore as much as we can the subject of inequality and why inequality is such a hot button issue. But on the subject of you know, her academic point, it was written in a very academic way, it's clear that that's her profession, you must see the difference between, on the one hand, a 1%, a small minority that was essentially powerless being persecuted by a majority, and on the other hand, a small minority that is extremely powerful, that has all the resources of modern society and wealth, being persecuted, I'll grant you, by a majority, namely the other 99%, although the group you're actually referring to is at various times several hundred protesters who are angry.
Well, no, I think the parallel holds. I mean, the typical German had never met a Jew, but some of the Jews were extremely wealthy, and they owned the large department stores and so forth and so forth. So they were very prominent, and I think it's a very good parallel.
You're saying that the average Occupy Wall Street protester has never met a rich person or somebody who rides a Google bus. Is that your point?
Probably. You know, I think so.
But do you concede the point that now you've chosen to speak for the 1%. I admire you for you. Not only do you have the courage of your convictions, but you have them repeatedly, right? This isn't the first time you've stepped up to defend yourself. But the 1% has certain advantages and ways of defending itself that an ethnic group that is being persecuted that is small does not. And I bring these up to ask.
I think I've sort of answered that already. I think if the Germany had American gun laws, there would have never been a Hitler. No, that's controversial.
If Nazi Germany had gun laws.
If Germany had America's gun laws.
America's gun laws, making guns widely available to the public.
Yes.
That the Jews then would
Hitler
have been able
have
to
never
defend
come
themselves.
To power.
Interesting.
So there.
You think so we're really straying off topic and we won't dwell on it, but okay. You're a fan of our current gun laws.
No, not particularly, but it's in our Constitution. I'm a fan of that. I don't have any guns.
Okay. We will agree that we won't illuminate your thinking anymore on the comparison of the rich 1% with the Jews in Nazi Germany.
But I'd like to talk about the nature of the persecution of the 1% here in America right now.
Sure.
Okay. And I'd like to start with some facts, which are always useful.
They may or may not be useful, but go ahead.
Well, we'll see. First of all, I don't think anybody has any idea what the 1% is actually contributing to America. Let me just get into that very quickly. I've got it here somewhere. Let me talk a little bit about, before I do that, about the persecution of the rich. And I'd like to take the Koch brothers. There are three of them. I know one of them, Bill, who has nothing to do with the other two that are highly political. But they're all big contributors to charities and so forth. And David Koch was on the board of New York Presbyterian Hospital, and the hospital was going bankrupt. So David gave $100 million to the hospital. And that was interpreted as Koch buying the hospital for the purposes of firing the nurses and destroying the nurses' union. So there was a big rally, and all kinds of important people showed up. The nurses said the Koch brothers have a plantation mentality, anti-union to the core. Harry Belafonte called them white supremacists. And then, let's see, Letitia James, who was head of the union, said right-wing anti-union profiteers like David Koch should not be meddling with healthcare in New York City. All have to stand together against the Koch brothers coming to New York City.
But Tom, so far these aren't facts, other than the $100 million.
The rally and what people said are facts.
Oh, I see. The facts are what people said. But you wanted to talk about the contribution that rich people make, which I think is an interesting line of discussion.
Let's just start with simple arithmetic. Let's say you're a successful author, and your income is taxed at a little over 50% if you live in California. On your death, there'll be another roughly 50% tax. So out of the dollar you originally made, you kept 25 cents. So you gave 75% of your lifetime's work in the form of taxes, not including property and other taxes. So that's on an individual basis. And I just learned something today that I suspect nobody in the audience is familiar with. Maybe you are. But if you sell your home and you're making more than $250,000 as a family, and you sell your home and there's a capital gain on the home, let's say you sell it, you want to buy a retirement home or something, Obamacare has added a 3.8% tax on your gain. How many of you knew that? Oh, quite a few. Okay. All right. I didn't know. All right. Finally, let me get to the actual statistics. I'll make this brief. The top 1% I got this from the Tax Foundation. These are facts. The top 1% of taxpayers pay a greater share of the income tax burden than the bottom 90% combined, which totals more than 120 million taxpayers. In 2010, the top 1% of taxpayers, which totals roughly 1.4 million taxpayers, paid about 37% of all income taxes. This is a big jump from 1985, when the top 1% paid a quarter of all income taxes. Indeed, the income tax burden on the bottom 90% has dropped, and the bottom 50% pays only 2.4% of total taxes. The top 10% of taxpayers, top 10%, pays 70.6%.
Okay.
So the argument of the rich are not paying their share, as Obama likes to say, and they could do more, and so forth and so forth. I mean,
let's be clear about what we're talking about. Yes. The argument is that there is a war against the rich, and
that's
that
right.
The rich are being persecuted.
Yes.
We're not having a conversation about whether or not the rich are doing enough. Your argument is that the rich are being persecuted. That's your point. Is this the persecution that you're referring to?
Well, of course. I think that taxation, I wouldn't say it's a form of persecution, but the extreme progressivity of the tax rate is a form of persecution.
But the extreme progressivity is not, first of all, is not new, and secondly,
it's getting worse.
But first it got better, to use your terminology, and now it's getting worse, to use your terminology. But it's not unprecedented. The Republic thrived and withstood high taxes before, and likely will again. I'm trying to put this in the scope of history to ask you, where is the persecution in that?
I think if you've paid 75% of your life's earnings to the government, you've been persecuted.
Okay,
I mean, let's just sum it up that way. Meanwhile, let's get back to the 99% for a minute and talk about them. They are not doing very well. They're doing extremely badly. Their income, I've got data on it, but in 1985, the average family making $250,000 a year paid 40% income tax. Today, they pay 47% income tax. And about half of that increase is Obamacare.
So I think we can all agree.
Nobody is having a wonderful time with taxes.
Well, it's an interesting point. I think everyone in the room would agree, and it's part of the reason why people came out to hear this conversation, is that the 99%, for lack of a better expression, because it's an inelegant and imprecise measure of those who are not super wealthy, right? But the 99% are hurting, to make a generalization. There is income inequality. You are agreeing with that.
I am totally agreeing.
So the question is, what to do about it? First of all, and secondly, there is a perception that you ought to address. There is a perception in the country, in San Francisco specifically, that the people who are making this great wealth essentially don't give a damn.
Well, I give a damn, and I'm concerned about what's happening to the non-1%. But San Francisco doesn't like the experience of becoming a suburb of Silicon Valley, and that's what's happening.
Explain. I feel like San Francisco, relatively speaking, especially in the technology community, is thriving as a center of job creation, of wealth creation.
That isn't what I said.
But how is it becoming a suburb?
Because the people in Silicon Valley are living in San Francisco more and more and more. Mm-hmm. And this is a trend that will continue. And why not? It's a great city. It has wonderful restaurants, great culture, one beautiful bay and everything. But the economic effect of that has been to drive up rents about 30%. So what to do about that? I don't think there's much you can do about that. That's inevitable. As Silicon Valley thrives, which it is, more and more people will want to live in San Francisco. And so then we have the phenomenon of Google buses, which I just find it almost incomprehensible to get angry about Google buses. But, you know, we started Google, and if they want buses, it's fine with me. But, you know, to break the windows in them and sort of rough people up, I think is preposterous. So now we have Google boats. So are they going to be out there shooting at the boats?
The specific issue is, I don't mind stating my opinion that boorish behavior is boorish behavior, and everyone should say that breaking windows is a bad idea. The question is, it's a philosophical question. Number one, should the city specifically be reimbursed handsomely for the use of its facilities, namely the bus stops? Number two, if we encourage companies like Google, and Google's not the only one, if we encourage them and their employees to opt out of the public transit system, is it only going to make the public transit system work? And again, do we care? Do you care about a good public transit system?
Is there a question in there?
Yes.
Somewhere?
Do you care about? Do you have an opinion on the use of city resources? And is there? And do you agree with the philosophical point that for example, public transit, public infrastructure is a good thing?
Of course, it is, and it's available for everybody. And Google is paying a fee for using the bus stops.
Belatedly.
Well, and but they're paying it. Now, is Google responsible for the rising rents in San Francisco? Indirectly, yes. What can they do about it? Nothing.
Now, we started down the path of what can be done about income inequality.
Right.
I think one of your...
I'd like to get on to that point, actually. I think that income inequality is been with us for a while, and it's caused by policy failures. And I think there's been a huge failure of social policy, fiscal policy, and monetary policy. So I hope I don't put you all asleep as I touch on those points. But let's start with social policy. You know, 50 years ago, Lyndon Johnson did two major things. He did the Civil Rights Act, which is marvelous, magnificent, and I think without criticism. He also did the War on Poverty, which had wonderful aspirations, but which has been an absolute total failure. It has caused all kinds of problems. First of all, there's more poverty now than there ever has been. When Johnson started out, the government was spending roughly 1% of its gross domestic product on taking care of the poor. Now that's closer to 5%. That's a huge increase. There's 77 million Americans on food stamps. But I think the biggest problem that Johnson unknowingly created was the destruction of the lower end of families in America. Now, back in the 60s and early 70s, the divorce rate between whites and blacks and Hispanics was about equal. It was about 12% across all of the sectors. The war on poverty made it possible to have single mothers supporting their children without a working man in the household. And so the numbers have just changed radically. The divorce rates have skyrocketed, but the to use a Victorian term, the birth rate out of wedlock has gone from 12%, which is pretty much uniform across all races in America, to 40% now for whites and over 70% for blacks.
And so I'm clear, you're drawing a straight line between the failed war on poverty and income inequality today.
I'm drawing a straight line between the failed war on poverty and the increase of poverty. Yes.
Is there, and you're talking, you started by talking about social spending. I think as I've read and listened to comments that you've made, you generally would subscribe to the theory that we have more government than we need, that we spend too much on government. First of all, that government spends too much generally. Is that a fair point?
Well, government is a giant beast that has to be fed, and the only way to feed it is with taxes. And taxes will just go up and up and up. I think Obamacare is probably...
The question I asked is, in your opinion, does the government generally spend too much?
Yes, it spends more than it takes in. It takes in $3 trillion a year in taxes, it spends closer to four.
But don't forget, we were talking about tax policy earlier. You're against higher taxes. Other people are for higher taxes. So presumably we could raise taxes to pay for these things, which gets me back to the question of, do we spend too much?
Well, we do spend too much. And there's so many examples of that, I don't think I need to. But taxes will rise. Now, there's been discussion by Nancy Pelosi. You're familiar with her?
Our congresswoman
of a wealth tax.
Your congresswoman.
Of a wealth tax. It would be 2% per year on your wealth. And somebody said, well, okay, let's say you're retired and your wealth is in your house and it's worth $1 million. And she said, that's no problem. The government will just take a 2% mortgage per year, and that's how we'll get the money. And she's also talked about a value-added tax and much higher taxes on the wealthy. The beast will be fed and taxes will go up. I don't know which or maybe perhaps all of these things will happen. The irony is if you took 100% of the 1%'s income and wealth, we're only talking about 1,400,000 people. That total would run the government for about a month.
Other than social spending, where would you cut?
I think that we're getting into an area where my bona fides are being stretched very thin. We really should have a panel of experts, but of course they wouldn't agree with each other, so you might as well go with what I've got to say.
Well, you are the man of the hour, so we have no alternative.
I don't know. I think entitlements are the obvious place that cuts have to be made, but they're built into the law, so that's extremely difficult. I'd like to skip on to...
Well, before you do, I ask this line of questioning to try to flesh out a point, which is, for example, one of your greatest successes in your illustrious venture capital career was Genentech. Genentech was one of the first and most successful biotech companies. Did Genentech and does Genentech benefit from basic medical research that the National Institutes of Health does?
Yes, more at university research, but yes.
So this is a good use of the federal government's...
I'm all for the federal government funding basic research. I'm for a strong military. And so on. We could go down the list, but entitlements are what is eating up the budget.
So to be clear, companies like Tandem and Compaq, which you invested in and made a lot of money and helped create a lot of jobs for, also benefited from military and other basic research by the U.S. government into the internet, without which none of Silicon Valley today would exist.
You're wrong on that. Tandem did no military business at all.
No, not directly, but the infrastructure that was established by
Adam,
computing.
You're barking up the wrong tree. I'm not going to go there. The squirrel is in a different tree.
Well,
I want to get back to the policy problems. So it's a social problem, policy, number one problem. Okay. Fiscal policy. Let's talk about that.
Well, we spend too much.
Well, we spend too much. The numbers are just incredible. And our debt is astronomical. It's the official debt is $17.2 trillion today. That includes Social Security. But it does not, and that's roughly 105% of our gross national product. Now, if you were an individual and you were earning $100,000 a year and you were spending $105,000, you had no other assets, you'd obviously be in trouble. But it's worse than that. The unfunded liabilities of Medicare, Medicaid, Fannie and Freddie, and so forth, adds up to $68 trillion on top of the $17 trillion. So we really have a debt-to-GDP ratio of pretty close to 400%. Now, many European countries have that. But many countries in the world don't have that at all. Australia has a ratio of 20%. Norway has, I think, zero. Norway has the largest sovereign wealth fund in the world of over $1 trillion. So policy matters, fiscal policy matters. It seems to me that the debt will not be paid back. There's no way to pay the
I want to ask you briefly how those factors you're discussing contribute to income inequality.
Well, it contributes to being so far in debt that you can't spend in things you should spend on because you're so hopelessly committed, and inevitably the taxes will just rise and rise and rise, which I don't think does anybody any good, 99% or 1% or whatever. But my point is, we're I think, on a knife edge with this incredible debt, which can't be paid back. I mean, it just can't be. It's supported by faith in the dollar. Now, Churchill took the UK off the gold standard in his second administration. Do you know who took us off the gold standard?
Nixon, I assume.
Yes, Nixon. So after that, it was just print money. You know, if you have a recession, print money. Stimulate the economy. Have inflation, print money. Devalue the dollar. So a dollar in 1970 was worth a dollar. Today it's worth 17 cents.
So let me make an observation as a way of moving on to other subjects, which
is...
I have a few more we need to cover before we go to the audience, but how is there a dissonance here that this horrible situation you describe is coexisting with this great period of wealth creation and job creation and the formation of great new companies like Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and Google that are in turn causing this consternation that we've come here to talk about
yes,
tonight?
Yes, and that gets me, thank you, directly to monetary policy.
You're welcome.
Okay. Now we have briefly
on monetary policy because it's the evening time and nobody wants to hear about monetary policy.
All right, let's hear about it for a minute. We've had low interest rates for a couple of decades, a little more. Very low, historically low for a long, long time. Now, investors with capital are seeking return on their capital. These low interest rates, you know, the rate on a 10-year treasury is 2.3%, I think, today. Very low. So investors are seeking returns of 7, 8, 10%. So an incredible amount of money, to get directly to your point, has flowed into venture capital. Now, when Eugene Kleiner and I, the late Eugene Kleiner, my dear friend.
And your co-founder of Kleiner Perkins.
And co-founder. When we started Kleiner Perkins, we tried to raise $10 million, and we couldn't. We raised $8 million. And that was the largest venture capital fund in the world. And everybody said, what are you going to do with it? Well, it turned out we had to start our own companies and so forth to make it work, but that's a different story. Now we have, I don't think anybody knows how many hundreds of billions of dollars in venture capital. The amount is immense.
Okay.
And that is causing the boom in San Francisco.
Okay.
Within a mile of here, there's probably 1,000 startups.
But in your opinion, these are good things.
No, not necessarily.
Why not?
Why not? Because these startups and students are dropping out of MIT in their junior year to come to San Francisco and do a startup. But they're not starting companies. They're writing software applications, which are products. A huge difference between a product and a company. And their only route to liquidity is to sell it to, you know, Google, Apple, whatever. And most of them will fail. And that's fine because there's so much money around, they can fail and then fail again and they'll keep getting financed. But it's not good for them. They're not getting the education that they should have gotten. They've dropped out. They're not learning how to be entrepreneurs. They're just writing software and applications. And there's so many millions. Somebody probably knows how many millions of applications there already are, but there's no great shortage of them.
So I see
the building boom, the housing boom, and all of this is a result of terrible monetary policy for 20 years.
I grant your point on monetary policy. This situation you describe of a flood of venture capital flooding, essentially what, to paraphrase, are a bunch of bad ideas or insufficient ideas, ideas that won't be real companies. Isn't this a great capitalist free-for-all? Isn't this just the market at work?
Yes, it is. And when the interest rate goes back up to 3%, it'll stop.
But I think, you know...
No, 7%, excuse me.
Okay.
I misspoke.
But it's a fascinating line of argumentation you're making. I think
some successes will come out of this. You know, it's like a petri dish. I mean, you know, some of them may bloom and blossom. And Kleiner Perkins has been pretty good at picking them.
But wasn't it like that in your days as an active venture capitalist as well, maybe at a smaller scale? You invested in young companies. Maybe they had a harebrained idea. Maybe they had a great idea. Maybe they were going to make money. Maybe they were going to have to go get a real job, right?
Well, you know, I could give a speech on venture capital in my sleep, which would put you all there, too. But I think that the unique thing about Kleiner Perkins and Sequoia and the other, I think, great venture capital firms is the management skills that they brought to the ventures. And typically, they would help the entrepreneur build his team. They wouldn't expect to find a team already built. I mean, who's going to become vice president of marketing of a startup number 780 until...
I understand.
Yeah. So the venture capitalists can fill that role and provide all that help and get the thing going. And, I mean, that's the difference between an angel investor who just sort of sprinkles gold over everything and a venture capital investor. And I'm not slamming Ron Conway because I think he's very good, but not all are.
You've referred to this conversation about the 1%. You referred to this 1% as the most creative part of our society.
Yeah.
Would you explain that? Because the war on the rich has been framed initially as the richest 1%, not the most creative 1%.
Well, there's a high correlation. I mean, look, you know, I guess Kleiner and I were in the business of creating billionaires. We didn't do so for ourselves. Well, we did all right, but 20, 30 billionaires that I could name that we've created, I mean, look at Google.
I'm confused. Is there a
correlation?
Couldn't there be a creative poet or a creative artist who is among the most creative 1% in the country? And why would you correlate creativity with wealth?
You are jumping into a completely different philosophical universe. You're talking about value, not wealth. I am talking strictly about the wealthiest 1%. Not the brightest, not the best poets, etc.
The word creative, though, was your word.
Well, yes. The wealthy 1% creates jobs. That's where they come from. Not the government. God, the government can't create a job to save its soul. I mean, you know, it spends millions and you get nothing. Or, I must say, the government is right now the biggest venture capitalist. I mean, look at, Solyndra, which has been beat to death. But even Kleiner Perkins. You know, we had an automobile company that borrowed money from the government. Not on my watch, but...
You're talking about Fisker?
Fisker, I'm talking about Fisker.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, so the government is in the venture capital. Everybody's in the venture capital. You're bound to get some good out of all that.
You mentioned to me earlier that you've been involved in controversy all your career.
Yes.
And your current controversy, you seemed surprised that the current partners of Kleiner Perkins are not on your side on this debate.
I don't really want to talk about that. I think basically they didn't have to say anything, and instead they threw me under the bus. But I'm a big boy. But I have had a lot of controversy in my life. You know, for a long time I was the world's foremost misogynist for firing Patty Dunn and Carly Fiorina at Hewlett Packard. And then when I was involved in Genentech, I was going to destroy the world by releasing Frankenstein bacteria as new forms of life. And there was a journalist in the Chronicle, maybe some of you remember, Charles McCabe, who just castigated me every day on that. And then when I started my laser company in the 60s, the rioters in Berkeley thought it was a death ray. And, I mean, and the year I ran the San Francisco Ballet effectively was a year of extreme controversy. Herb Cain called me, essentially an idiot, in charge of doing something he has no qualifications whatsoever to do, which is true. But But the guy I hired, Helgi Thomason, is still there 27 years later. So
we're almost—it's almost time for audience questions. You mentioned Herb Cain. You started your comments by mentioning the San Francisco Chronicle. Are you surprised that the San Francisco Chronicle has a populist tone in its pages?
I think there's only one newspaper in the United States that doesn't have a populist tone, and it's the only newspaper in the United States that's making any money, and that's the Wall Street Journal.
Well, point of fact, other newspapers make money, but it's not the only one. I believe USA Today makes money. New York Times makes money.
Not a newspaper. And New York Times does not make money.
I'm not sure, but it's a public company, so we could go check afterwards.
We could go check.
Anyway, the question I asked is, are you surprised that by their... You've made comments suggesting that you are surprised or shocked or upset or something by the Chronicle's tone.
Well, I read the Chronicle every day. I want to know what's going on in town. I never read the editorial page. I mean, I could predict the editorial page. I don't need to read it. And I read the New York Times every day and the Wall Street Journal. And I don't get my information off the Internet like everybody else does. And I think I know a lot more than the people that do get it off the Internet, but that's a matter of personal opinion.
You mentioned earlier to me that you've noticed a difference in the reaction you've gotten in the last handful of weeks between people who email you on the one hand and people who comment about you on Twitter on the other hand. Share that with everybody?
That's very interesting. I've received a huge number of letters and emails, all very supportive of my position, 100%. And the Twitters are all pretty negative. And it's an age difference. You know, older people use email and younger people Twitter.
My last question for you, Tom. You were asked...
When they're not playing video games.
You were asked recently in a television interview if you feel that you're connected to reality. During that interview, you talked about your expensive watch and used to own. Your response to the question of whether or not you're connected to reality was, I'm paraphrasing, I give a lot of money to charity.
Well, I do give a lot of money to charity, but that has nothing to do with my connection to reality. I think philosophically, probably no one can prove that they are connected to reality. The whole idea... So I'm in the same boat with everybody else. How about you, Adam? You're a celebrated interviewer. Are you attached to reality?
My guess would be that one of the ways you answered the questions also was that although your immediate family is doing fine, that you have relatives who live in trailer parks. Yeah. And I think the point you were making was you know poor people.
Well, I wasn't born into the 1%. And, I used to be a paper boy, which is, of course, now illegal because of child labor and minimum wages. You know, I used to bag groceries and babysit, et cetera, et cetera. That's outlawed. But so it goes.
We have a wonderful, vibrant audience here with a wonderfully vibrant interview subject tonight. So I want to invite you to stand up and go to the microphone to ask questions. I'll remind you that these need to be questions, and if they aren't questions, I will apologize in advance for being rude to you to remind you to ask a question. Sir, please go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for coming tonight. I appreciate you visiting this audience. With socioeconomic disparity or disinclusion, however you want to say it, particularly in cities, being really the civil rights issue of our time, and you being so connected to, you're kind of a Brahmin of financial value creation, you being connected to people like Google founders, not to mention the VC community that you run in, would you be willing to be part of, say, a fund in which you give 1% of your money to and help manage that fund and the use of that fund that harnesses the entrepreneurial talent of San Francisco to address urban poverty issues that the tech economy or the emerging economy at large is exacerbating?
I think I heard most of that. I'm not part of such a thing, but it is such a thing is being organized by Ron Conway and Mark Benowitz,
Benioff.
Benioff, excuse me. And I don't know, I'm not familiar with the details of it, but they are trying to do exactly what you have said for the benefit of San Francisco.
And I don't know if you caught it, at the very end of it, the tail end of his question, he injected the premise that the tech community is exacerbating the problems of poverty in San Francisco specifically.
Well, they're not. They're making enough to pay higher rents, and but I don't see that as exacerbating the problems of poverty. No.
I wanted to say thank you. I wanted to say, as a reminder to our radio audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's InForum, Connect Your Intellect. For more about InForum and its upcoming events, please visit us on Facebook or follow at InForumSF on Twitter. Tonight we're hosting Tom Perkins, The War on the 1%, and we have another question in the audience. Please.
Hi, Mr. Perkins. I'm a student at Stanford Law School, and in my free time from playing video games, two of the things I do are...
Well, we started Electronic Arts. That's great.
One of the things I do is work in the community law clinic, mostly with Spanish-speaking people from East Palo Alto. The other thing I do is I teach a class on California's finances. From these different contexts, I've gleaned, first of all...
We need to have your question. I'm sorry. This is a question for Tom Perkins.
What ought I tell the people that I work with in East Palo Alto? If you could speak to them, what would you say?
Thank you.
I feel very sorry for them. I wish that the war on poverty had not been such a fiasco, and then they wouldn't have the problem that they now have. The solution will take a very long time, and it depends a lot on education, which is getting worse, I think, because of, frankly, the teachers' union is making it impossible to have quality schools in the inner cities, and so on and on. There's no quick answers to these kinds of questions, I'm afraid, at least not from me. From Barack Obama, yes, they flow.
Over here, please.
Hi, hello, good evening. Thank you very much for coming and sharing. So you made a lot of statements about pointing fingers, but one of the things you didn't address was like the role of financial literacy, the role of access, and the role of race plays in a lot of these things. So if you could just highlight maybe your thoughts on how are you bringing financial literacy to a lot of these communities, and what are your thoughts on some of the ways that you've contributed to that or just opportunities to do that?
I think I got most of that. Silicon Valley is a meritocracy. It is simply a meritocracy. Race has nothing whatsoever to do with it. But blacks are underrepresented in Silicon Valley, unfortunately. Now, there's a group here in San Francisco. They're successful black businessmen of all kinds. And they formed something called Wall Street Wizards. And what they are trying to do is teach young blacks about business and how to succeed in that. And last year, during National Black Awareness Week, or that may be the wrong title, I agreed to speak to that group. And all of the mentors showed up, and not a single student, not one. So... It must come from the individuals. It can't all come from the government or a program. If the individuals don't want to learn, they won't.
Please.
Yes, you cited Johnson's war on poverty as a disaster that led to more poverty and increased the number of children born out of wedlock. What should have been done back then that would have had a different outcome?
I think the answer to that is very, very long, and I'm not sure I have all those answers. We certainly did the wrong thing. What the right thing would have been, I'm not so sure.
I would encourage you, I've learned that you are able to form an opinion on almost anything, Tom. It is your opinion that the war on poverty has been a failure, but that is not accepted fact.
Wait a minute. No, come on.
No, you don't know that there are not factors that would have made things, that things would have been even worse without the things that were done.
That's
and
conceivable.
So I think he's asking a fair question, which is, broadly speaking, what would have been the better policy route than the policy route that was taken in the Johnson administration?
Well, I think Johnson had absolutely no idea that what he was doing was wrong, and it looked good, and everybody approved it. But it had the result of destroying families. It just did. And then that destroyed the education of the children in those families and so forth. So it had a cascading effect. And the rate of poverty is higher now than it ever has been in history. There's 77 million Americans on food stamps. So there's no way, I don't know how bad it could have gotten. I don't know.
So I'll take a shot for you. Instead of the programs that the Johnson administration did put into place, if the Johnson administration and the Nixon administration instead had focused on deregulation and, you know, making government smaller, that we would have less poverty today.
That's a trap. I'm not going to go into it. I think if money had been spent on improving the educational standards. I mean, let's face it, we are, I don't know, what are we, 64th or something among the nations badly educated. We've totally underinvested in education, and we've made it very, very hard to get a good education in the United States. And if I had to pick a single thing, that's what I would pick. That should have been done differently.
Please.
Could you comment on the fact that your own example of fiscal and responsibility Norway is a social democracy? Are you advocating social democracy for the United States?
you're talking. I'm a knight of Norway. I've got to, you know, defend it. There are no tall poppies in Norway. No tall poppies. Well, it's the old adage, the tall poppy gets cut first. So everybody is pretty much the same. There's no poverty, and there are no rich. They've left Norway because they didn't want to pay the taxes. So it's not an ideal example. I just threw it in because they've done so extraordinarily well in husbanding their resources, namely their oil. You know, Norway has been the number two oil exporter for decades, next to Saudi Arabia. And they've saved the money, and because someday the oil will be gone, but they've got the money. If I were 20 years old, of course I think I'm in my midlife crisis now anyway, but if I were 20 years old, I'd try to go to Australia. I mean, Australia is, to me, and I spent a lot of time there, the way California was when I came here in 1957. It was upbeat, positive, can-do, unaware of all kinds of problems. That's the way Australia is now, and all we do is worry about our problems.
But when you do go down to Mountain View, you don't think of that, or when you walk around Market Street, you don't think of that as an upbeat, can-do environment?
Well, not 7th and Market. I mean, that's a good place. That's a good place.
Okay,
to
we're getting
up.
We're getting too local in this conversation. Go ahead.
Hi, I work at Genentech, and I'd first like to thank you for creating my job. Secondly, I've been to, you know, knowing a little bit about Genentech, I know a huge chunk of our revenue comes from Medicare payments, and so that you had mentioned earlier, like cutting entitlements, that would significantly cut our revenue. So that's one example of a public-private, you know, revenue partnership or whatever. There's also, you know, construction and infrastructure and education you mentioned. And so if this revenue that's being spent by the government isn't going to create jobs, like what is it doing if it's not helping keep people employed at Genentech?
Hang on. I think Medicare is great. Great.
One of the biggest entitlement programs there is.
It is. It's just underfunded.
You want to make this entitlement program bigger.
No, I want to make sure it doesn't go bankrupt. There's a difference.
I don't understand.
You don't understand.
If we need to cut entitlement programs, then we need to cut entitlement programs.
Adam,
yes.
Medicare will go bankrupt. It's inevitable. So taxes have to be spent on Medicare. I'm for that.
And so the entitlements that you're against are?
I didn't say I was against entitlements. I never said that.
You said they need to be cut.
Yes, because that's the bulk of the budget. I mean, there's very little discretionary cutting you can do. I mean, the military and a handful of this and that. But entitlements represent most of the budget. So if you're going to cut the budget, which we have to do because we're so deeply in debt, you've got to start there. But there are good ones and there are bad ones.
And the bad ones are?
I doubt that 77 million people need to be on food stamps.
Food stamps, okay. Next question, please.
Hi, I have a speech impediment, so in case you don't understand, I'll be happy to repeat myself. I'm part of the 99% that aspires to be the 1% someday, right? I work 70, 90 hours a week to make sure that someday, hopefully, I'll become the 1%. And so do you think this could be potentially an image problem for the 1%? There's billionaires out there who we love, like Steve Jobs, yeah. Musk, Bill Gates. Do you think instead of calling this the war on the 1%, if we could actually address it as the race to the 1%, things would be a lot better for everybody?
I think that's a brilliant rebranding, and I totally subscribe to it, but that's not my message is the demonization of the 1%. And I think that's true, and it's new. It's frankly new with the Obama administration. We never used to have a demonization of the 1%. We wanted to be in the 1%. We admired them. I can remember when I was a little kid, John D. Rockefeller would go around and give dimes to little children. And I thought, how wonderful. You know, I'd like to be John D. Rockefeller and give dimes. But this whole tone has changed.
But
in the last very recent years under this administration, I think.
But not being philanthropic enough, is that what you're asking?
Well, I've discussed the taxes. I mean, the 1% is carrying the government. That at least the top 10% is carrying the government. So we've talked about that. It's not bad to be in the 1%, obviously. And I think people like yourself still aspire to it and should. And hard work and so on can get you there, plus the right venture capitalists.
Over here, please.
The president has proposed a lot of common sense ideas around immigration reform, around infrastructure spending, but at every turn he's been roadblocked by the Republicans in Congress failing to wanting to agree with him on moving a policy agenda forward. And
yes,
what is your thoughts on the politics of no,
okay,
as opposed to proposing an alternative agenda?
I'm neither a Republican or a Democrat. I've won both ways. I voted for Jerry Brown, and he raised my taxes 30%. But President Obama made an immense political mistake. He's not a politician. He's a brilliant leader in a certain direction. The mistake was to push through Obamacare without a single Republican vote. No other president would have done that because it just wiped out any hope of cooperation with the other party. So there is, in spite of all his talk about reaching across the aisle and so forth, nothing has happened. So you can blame it on the Republicans, but I blame it on a huge strategic political mistake.
It's the president's obstinacy in wanting his agenda passed that is to blame for other party's intransigence.
I think it's what you get when you elect an amateur president.
Tom, is that really fair? He's a politician who was elected by the people of the United States, not once but twice. So why the name calling?
I looked at his resume.
And you've never met an entrepreneur who had never been an entrepreneur before, or a venture capitalist who had never made an investment before.
But I wouldn't make him president of the United States.
Over here, please.
Hi. So you just said that it's not bad being in the 1%, but you're also talking about the demonization of the 1%. So, you know, we do know exactly what happened to the Jews in Europe. So I'm actually curious what the fear is. You know, I mean, it can't possibly be ghettoization or deportation
but I do want to understand what the actual fear is. The fear is wealth tax, higher taxes, higher death taxes, just more taxes until there is no more 1%. And then that'll creep down to the 5% and then the 10%. The money is in the middle. That's where the money in America is. And to pay for this government, it's going to have to come from the 99%, not the 1%. And you know, in the form of taxes, value-added taxes, I promise you, higher taxes.
So
everybody.
So to be fair, and I'm sorry to tell you that this is Tom's penultimate word, and he will get the last word, but your point is, to her question, that your concern is a decrease in the overall quality of life in the United States, including for rich people, but not only for rich people.
No, that's right.
As opposed to ghettoization, extermination, and other horrible things.
I'm talking about economic extinction, not physical extinction. Okay, before coming here, I was told that every speaker gets a question on how to save the world.
The precise question is, and this is the way that Inform ends all of its events, what is your 60-second idea to change the world?
Okay, and I've been thinking about this as I was listening to you ramble on. And I've got it. And it's going to make you more angry than my letter to the Wall Street Journal.
I highly doubt it, but let's hear it.
Oh, you're not ready. Thomas Jefferson, at the beginning of this country, thought that to vote you had to be a landowner. Now, that didn't last very long, and the vote was given to everyone. But the basic idea was you had to be a taxpayer or a person of property to vote. That went by the boards. Margaret Thatcher tried to change that in England in what became called as the poll tax. The idea was that every single citizen of the UK had to pay something in taxes, even if they got it back in subsidies elsewhere. And if you didn't pay something in taxes, you couldn't vote. And she was thrown under the bus by her own party for trying to push that through. So the Tom Perkins system is, you don't get to vote unless you pay a dollar of taxes. But what I really think is, it should be like a corporation. If you pay $1 million in taxes, you should get 1 million votes. How's that?
Well, it's a you're right that I don't agree with you. It's you're wrong that I'm angry. I would point out to you the flaw in your argument is that since everybody pays sales tax and anyone who drives a car pays taxes for that, then we're right back where we started in the wonderful place where we've evolved since Thomas Jefferson with everybody having the vote,
but not income tax
or property tax. And I for one have enjoyed this conversation immensely despite my rambling. Tom, thank you. Please, everyone in the room, join me in giving a big round of applause to Tom Perkins. And now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.